Chapter 36. Paul the Lawyer. Who has not read of Paul the missionary, or Paul the great preacher, or Paul the faithful pastor? Of course he was all of these, and much more in the same line. And he was something else that we do not hear so much about. He was a great lawyer, greater it seems than John Marshall, or Daniel Webster, or Abraham Lincoln. A man is always remembered longest for the thing in which he was the greatest, and Paul was so great as a missionary, greater than any who ever lived, and such a great preacher and writer that his abilities as a lawyer do not seem so wonderful as they really were. But if Paul were living today, he would be considered a very distinguished lawyer. One of the few things we know of Paul's early life is that he was a student of Gamaliel, a great teacher of the law, and Gamaliel must have been very proud of his bright, keen scholar whom he made those wonderful arguments before Festus and Agrippa and the Jewish Sanhedrin, and perhaps before the Emperor Nero himself. Of course, the laws which Paul studied were mostly the laws of Moses, and not such laws as lawyers study nowadays. But it may be that if our law schools were to teach more of the laws of Moses, we should have more lawyers like Paul. It is almost certain that Paul's practice as a lawyer was not very extensive. In fact, so far as we know, he never had but one client, and that was himself. It was an old adage that a man who is his own lawyer has a fool for a client, but that was not true of Paul. His defense of himself in every trial of which the record is preserved was wonderfully able and brilliant. His arguments are models of logic and eloquence, and his keen thrusts and pointed questions showed that he was more than a match for his opponents. Every lawyer should study Paul, and none can fail to learn much from the cool, lawyer-like way in which he presents his arguments and states his conclusions in all his addresses and writings. It was well indeed for Paul, and well for us too, that he was skilled in the law and knew his rights so well, for he was often placed in positions where this knowledge and ability were of the greatest value to him. It does not lessen our love and admiration for Paul that he insisted upon the rights which the law gave him. He was a free-born Roman citizen, and the Romans had a law that if any judge or ruler should condemn or even chastise a free man of Rome without hearing him speak for himself and then deliberating upon the whole of his case, he should be liable to the sentence of the people, who were very jealous of their liberties. The first time Paul took advantage of this law was in Jerusalem, where he had gone to worship and to take to the poor Jews of Judea gifts from their more fortunate countrymen in Europe and Antioch. Upon the advice of James and the elders, he had consented to go into the temple with four other Jews and offer the sacrifices of a Nazarite to prove that he had not, as was charged, advised the people of Europe and Asia to forsake the law of Moses. While doing this, he was discovered by some Asiatic Jews, who forthwith raised a riot, shouting out that Paul had brought Greeks into the temple and polluted the holy place. Mob rule is always unreasonable and generally punishes the wrong man. These fanatics supposed that Trophimus, an Ephesian, had been with Paul in the temple, but in this they were mistaken. Paul, however, had no chance to explain, but was pulled out of the temple, and the doors were shut to prevent the possibility of bloodshed within its holy precincts. When we see churches nowadays locking their doors 6 days in the week, while men and women and boys and girls are going to saloons and theaters and billiard parlors for the diversion which their social natures crave, we are apt to think of Paul left to die outside the closed doors of the temple. As the mob were beating him, the chief captain, Claudius Lysias, in charge of the Roman forces, came with a company of soldiers and rescued him, and after binding him with two chains, carried him into the castle, followed by the bloodthirsty crowd shouting, "Away with him!" Few men have ever had as much personal experience with mobs as the great apostle. He had barely escaped with his life upon several occasions, and at Lystra had been stoned and left for dead. But these had no terror for the man who had looked into the face of the ascended Lord on the Damascus road. As he was carried up the castle stairs by the burly soldiers, he asked permission to speak to the frantic crowd, and the chief captain, having given permission, the chained prisoner quietly facing the raging multitude beckoned with his hand, and the tumultuous mob was hushed into a great silence. There are in all history few scenes more striking and heroic than this. Paul's motto all through his public life was, "I am ready." No occasion ever found him unprepared. He was always master of the situation, and here, at a moment's notice, in a most unusual and unexpected crisis, he had a powerful sermon ready to be spoken and worthy to be printed in full in the New Testament. We can only imagine what Paul intended further to say to his excitable audience, for when he announced that his mission was to the Gentiles, the meeting broke up in confusion. He must have known that this statement would raise another disturbance, but a little thing like that never interfered with Paul's telling the truth. As they cried out to drown his voice and tore off their clothing and threw dust into the air, the chief captain saved Paul's life a second time by locking him in the castle and ordered him to be examined or whipped in order that he might be induced to confess his great crimes. This sample of Roman justice gives us a glimpse into the stupid and brutal methods of dealing with persons accused of crime. We have not yet succeeded in getting rid of all injustice of this kind. If the chief captain had scourged a few of the ringleaders of the howling mob, there would have been in this procedure at least some indication of common sense. But to punish Paul before he had been found guilty of any offense was surely very foolish as well as unlawful. And Paul's question to the centurion, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is Roman and uncondemned?" fell like a bomb in the castle. Quickly the suggestion was carried to the chief captain. "Take heed what thou doest, for this man is a Roman." And when Paul had explained to him in answer to his inquiry that he was not only a Roman freedman, but he had been born free, thus putting himself above the captain, who had merely purchased his freedom, those who should have examined him departed from him, and the powerful military official also was afraid because he had handcuffed him. It fills us with admiration for the old heathen government to realize how it threw its powerful protecting arm around its most humble citizen. That was a protection recognized all over the civilized world, for Rome was its master. Today it means much to be an American citizen if one is in a foreign land. Our government would send a gunboat half round the world to protect one of its citizens oppressed by a foreign power, and we would all throw up our hats and applaud. On the morrow, the chief captain adopted a somewhat safer and saner method of getting all the facts. Calling for a special session of the Jewish Council, or Sanhedrin, to try his resourceful prisoner, and loosing Paul's bands, he brought him down and set him before them. When we read of the methods of the Roman courts, we have to confess that our own methods present less of an improvement than we could wish. There still is much to be desired in our own country. Here was a court where Paul must have felt very much at home. It is barely possible that he was at one time a member of it, and without doubt was well acquainted with many of the judges, for only on the previous day he had called upon the high priest and council to bear witness to the truth of his statements. Without waiting, therefore, for an invitation, he immediately proceeded to assert his innocence of any wrongdoing, but was rudely interrupted by the high priest, Ananias, who directed those standing by to slap him on the mouth. We do not know whether or not the order was obeyed, for Paul let it be known that here again he knew his rights under the law. "God shall smite thee, thou whited wall, for sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law?" When members of the council gently chided him for speaking thus to the high priest, Paul's reply was tinged with sarcasm and might almost be read, "I hardly supposed from his conduct that he was any longer the high priest." While the judges were probably wrangling over how to proceed with this refractory prisoner, Paul showed that he not only knew the law, but that he was skillful in the trial of cases. Every lawyer defending a prisoner whom he believes to be innocent tries to get a verdict of not guilty, but if he fails in that, the next best thing is a hung jury, for that gives him another chance. Paul knew very well that he stood no chance of a verdict in his favor, and so he went after the next best thing. The council was composed of two classes or sects, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, which held different religious beliefs and which were very jealous of each other, and Paul took advantage of this circumstance to hang the jury. "Men and brethren," he cried, "I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Of the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am called in question." Instantly there was an uproar. The dignified court of justice threw dignity to the winds, as its judges lined up to do physical battle if need be in support of their convictions. Never was a prosecution dealt a body blow with more neatness and dispatch. Never did certain conviction fade more quickly into hopeless disagreement. The world's famous trials contain nothing equal to this, and no lawyer has ever had more reason to congratulate himself upon the outcome of his case. We can almost see the little apostle, for Paul is said to have been small in size, standing calmly and quietly, and perhaps smilingly watching the effect of his strategy, as there arose a great cry and a great dissension, one side clamoring for his conviction and the other for his acquittal, until the chief captain, fearful lest his prisoners should be pulled to pieces, was obliged to lead his big soldiers the third time to the rescue. Some have doubted whether Paul did right in his method of conducting his defense, but let no one have any doubts on that score, for that night the Lord appeared to Paul and assured him that his testimony in Jerusalem must be repeated in Rome. No lawyer to whom the Lord appears at night with such a message need worry over the way he tried his case the day before.